us today as well. For those of you who are aware of the Black Lives Matter movement, the Movement for Black Lives, there are some official chapters of the movement, and there is an official chapter called the DMV for District Maryland and Virginia chapter, and both Aaron and Omalara work with that official chapter. They build relationship and are extremely active in organizing with others for collective liberation. And I want us all to welcome them, and as Paula said, invite them to share what they would like about themselves rather than doing formal bios or introductions. But just to say that they do a lot of important work with the DMV chapter of the Black Lives Matter movement, and that Aaron also has organized the Well Examined Life, which you can share more about with you. But I want to hope all of you are joining in welcoming them and giving them our attention. It's a great honor for us to be having all three of our speakers. So, Aaron.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. I actually love bios, I just don't like writing them. I really love hearing other people describe me. I don't know, it's kind of interesting. One of my friends had someone have a bio about me, and I was like, that's not how I talk about myself. And she was just like, you do so much work, could your family describe you accurately in a reasonable amount of time? I was like, no, probably not. And how I describe myself often changes with the day. But thank you very much, Kay, for that wonderful introduction. One thing I will say is that we have shifted our name from Black Lives Matter DMV to Black Lives Matter DC. We used to have organizers in Maryland and Virginia, and now everybody has moved to DC, and we're working to build other chapters in Northern. What's what I said?
I know, you said moved to DC.
Oh. Yeah, there were actually DC natives who couldn't afford to live in DC who now moved back and working to create chapters in Northern Virginia and Southern Maryland. So I have a lot of things that I want to say, and I'm trying to figure out how to put them into a coherent 15-minute talk, which probably won't happen, but you know, whatever. Thank you so much, Alonzo, for speaking and giving the overview. I kind of wanted to start off with a little bit of a counter history of how I sort of view where we're at and some differences in how I look at it. I think Stokely Carmichael has this really great quote that I think is really important today, which is, if a white man wants to lynch me, that's his problem. If a white man has the power to lynch me, that's my problem. And I kind of put the critique of where we're at as we have a lot of stories about power and capital, and white supremacy is one story in a series of institutions that help instill a specific relationship between different folks to power and capital. And so I sort of start from this point that white people didn't create white supremacy. In fact, white supremacy was a story created by a small group of landowners who wanted to naturalize or make it seem like, oh, this is the only way it could be, a relationship between folks from Europe who had land and everybody else. And so they created this idea of whiteness, which is both a kind of sort of access to certain institutions, laws that allow you to have a certain place in society, but also is a set of interests that a group of people have and a set of behaviors that they have to sort of, conform to. Right, and so whiteness is this cultural idea, it's also a marker of power, and it's also access to capital. And these three things sort of explain how we get to where we are now. And it's not so much in that, sometimes we tell a story, which is not the story that Alonzo told, but sometimes a story that we tell that, like, humans just, you know, don't like other people, and sometimes over time that gets like concretized, and over centuries, one group that doesn't like the other person has more resources and then they make themselves superior. What actually happened is that all over the world in the 14 and 1500s, there were a bunch of different competing interests in Europe who, some people who, as feudalism was crumbling, wanted to either go to this communal structure where a lot of peasant revolts and a lot of European peasantry were trying to go to this third option that wasn't feudalism but wasn't capitalism, where there could be communal control of resources. And the story of whiteness that we have now is sort of a story of domination that was used to justify the creation of capitalism in Europe that then got exported through settler colonialism in America. And I think when we think about issues such as integration and whether we're better off because of integration now than we were decades ago, I think it's important to understand that relationship to power and capital, right? Is that black people were put in a very specific position in America as a group, right? We were singled out because of our skin, because of our heritage, in order to make it seem natural that we would work for free. And this was a group identity and a structure created in a group. And then integration comes along and says, individuals, there's a new meritocracy, and individuals can come into this system as individuals. They're going to be colorblind, and we're just going to take away this racial designation that allows you to integrate. And what ended up happening is that all of this communal identity, communal structures, and belief in communalism was destroyed in order to allow some black folks, largely the rising black middle class, to get access to some economic benefits in the existing system, right? And so liberals in the 60s have their big heyday, and they look at the system and say, poor people are this special group of people who have just been marginalized by society, and we need to have programs that help poor people. And the problem with black people is that so many of them are poor. And so we have this war on poverty and these other programs targeted at poverty. And so there are some issues with race about how that money went, how it got spent, and that we didn't address race. But there's also this other problem that's fundamental with liberals, which is that we don't understand the class dynamics and the structures and the interests that make poverty, right? Poverty is a symptom of capitalism. The same way that beliefs in in black inferiority is a symptom of white supremacy. There are systems that create this output. And so if you just look at the output but don't look at what created it, you're never actually going to get to the root problem. And so we had integration, and so people got to go to better schools. Some schools were better funded, but it also went to this entire attack on communal ideas, right? And schools used to be community centers where teachers who maybe weren't paid that well didn't have as much money in black schools as they did in white schools, but there were all of these other communal support systems that existed in black communities and around black schools that allowed black children to succeed. In a sort of, I didn't even know what the word, there's sort of a race consciousness, right, that I think is what you hear when you hear a lot of like Jim Crow nostalgia. It's like, you know, black people in my day in the 40s were really together, and they knew they were black, and they just knew they had to work hard, and there was just this barrier that didn't allow us to do it, and our teachers cared about us, and yes, they may have whipped us, which is like a thing that I feel like folks just kind of say. Like, it was just this like secondary thing. It's actually a pretty big deal. Getting beat as a kid, don't like that. And I think it's important to understand that, right? That nuance when you talk about integration, was that integration was part of a larger liberal project of taking away communal ideas, taking away teachers' unions, taking away the idea that you support the actual community. And then we have a place now in my generation where the school was supposed to do everything. Teachers are supposed to be social workers, they're supposed to be psychiatrists, they're supposed to be police officers. Education is this thing that's supposed to overcome all of the disabilities I had as a child. It's supposed to overcome my bipolar disorder. It's supposed to overcome like 400 years of racism. It's supposed to overcome 1,000 years of patriarchy, and we've completely defunded it, but it's supposed to do all of these things. And then when we say, well, integration was the thing that worked, so it must be the teacher's fault that like black kids aren't learning. And I think it's important that we take this more nuanced look. So that was part one. part two, I guess, is to talk a little bit about the stories we tell about ourselves. And so Black Lives Matter DC operates from an idea that love is an important operating force, right? Because one of the overarching problems with the way our society is created is that we actually have a distinctly loveless culture, right? That like there's all of these things that separate us from each other in order to kind of separate resistance so you can just put on any exploitative system on top of us, right? We're all individually trying to get our careers instead of moving our community forward. We're all trying to have these really small, really fragile nuclear families that's one cisgendered man and one cisgendered woman taking care of two cisgendered kids, which like has never actually been a thing that any successful society has had, right? But then it becomes that family's fault and those two families' fault when the family doesn't move forward, instead of having these communal ideas, right? And we start to tell ourselves that everybody's out to get something from us. That if, you know, if there's a disaster, like when Hurricane Katrina happened, if there's a disaster, we're all just gonna attack each other, because what we really need to do is just get resources, right? And so putting the focus on the individual, taking away the history of resistance, taking away the history of communal structures, allows us to all be isolated and to be exploited as individuals, right? And so one thing that Black Lives Matter tries to do is look at how love allows us to have communal ideas and communal resistance. And so instead of taking what is often called the elements of middle-class dominant culture, which talks about individualism and perfectionism and a sense of urgency in defending what you have to get forward, we're trying to build a communal understanding of resistance and tell a different story about how we got here and where we need to go. And so part of that is an understanding that the story we tell about America, as Alonzo put out, and here where Andrew Jackson is this like really great leader who pushed rugged individualism out to the West and like opened up America in this really interesting way, is not a real story about how change happens. And so now that we're here in 2016, our story of moving forward has to be a different story. Sort of brings us in this room to about how does the several communities that I'm a part of relate to your community. So what I want to talk about now is how we sort of look at structurally white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, and alienation as these systems of oppression that separate us from our human potential, separate us from our ability to love each other and our ability to think communally, and how Black Lives Matter DC is working to dismantle those and what that actually looks like. So the first thing that we focus on, and I'm sure Omolar will talk a bit about, is how patriarchy relates to white supremacy, right? And so we often have patriarchy, whether you call it the rule of the fathers or the belief in male supremacy, does a lot of things that are actually super useful for white supremacy to take a hold of. One of those things is a sort of leadership structure and this idea of just like the rugged individuals, and you just have to be objective and you have to everything's rational and you don't talk about your emotions and you have a strong leader who just leads and everybody else follows, right? And that's a patriarchal way of understanding leadership. It's also what you often hear people of color talk about white institutions as, right? Like Black people can't have, when Black people show emotions, we're the angry Black woman or the threatening Black man, right? It's very related, because what this is actually about is separating groups of people and keeping power and capital into other people and then creating a culture of lovelessness between individuals to make it seem natural and to help sort of police those barriers. And then you have alienation, which is often this idea that we have all of these institutions that are supposed to do work for us. This idea that our government and the companies we work for, we just put in work into a system, and then the system that's not accountable to us, that doesn't ask us what our needs are, that doesn't sort of ask us how it's supposed to be run, is supposed to support us. And so we become alienated from all these institutions because, again, we don't have a communal nature that says we're gonna come together and actually discuss who's gonna pick up the trash, how we're gonna keep our community safe, how we're gonna distribute medical supplies. We no longer have a moral economy that sees it as the community's interest to control its institutions for the benefit of the community, these institutions are sold to us as good unto themselves, right? The House of Congress is this sacred thing that we're supposed to support, and we're supposed to vote because it's our sacred duty as citizens to support this institution that we all feel at this point doesn't actually care about us and is actually at this point incapable of putting our interests forward, right? And so when we see this alienation, the institutions that we're alienated from operate on these different logics, right? They operate on the logic of patriarchy, they operate on the logic of white supremacy, and so you see people being multiply marginalized, right? So not only do I live in a world in which you know, society puts limitations on how I can express my emotions, how I can express myself, how I can think, how I can lead, because it wants it to be in this small, very frail, masculine box. But I also live in a world that doesn't actually think I have the potential for real leadership because I'm a black person. And then you put me in these institutions that don't actually want to represent me and aren't actually set up to hear my voice, and you can just see the marginalization stack up. And then when you get to white supremacy, you have all of these institutions that are strongly tied to what Alonzo called the white nationalist idea, right? So like there are all of these code words for whiteness that you hear, and even you hear, which is something I think is kind of blows my mind, when people say we're a Christian nation, it's really funny to me how they're used Christian to mean white, even though black people, I think, have a higher percentage of our population actually as Christians than most other groups in America. But there's this thing, right? We know that the most segregated time in America is 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. And so you know when they're talking about their Christianity, they're talking about blonde hair, blue-eyed Jesus, and they're talking about all of these cultural institutions that support their Christianity. And white nationalism becomes the story of American society and American institutions. And you talk about all of these things that America was founded on, and rugged individualism, and like settlers who just wanted freedom, when we know actually the settlers wanted land, and they took land from First Nation people, and they used whiteness to justify that. And white nationalism becomes this story that all of these other institutions play into. And so this is a long, long drawn out way to talk about sort of understanding how these systems work in an intersectional way, right? That these stories of white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, and alienation it wouldn't be accurate to say that to understand how I interact in society and how society interacts with me is to say, these are the privileges of masculinity, this is what black oppression looks like, this is what it means to be working class, and you're just gonna like throw them into a list, pick them out, and like that's what Aaron's life is. What we actually see is that you have a reimagining of my human potential, what the system, how the system should interact with me, and how I should be like compensated by or exploited by the system is based on my identity. It's reimagined. So as a working class, queer black man, like the system looks at me as that and addresses me and interacts with me in that way, and that's the way that I have to overcome it. 20 minutes is a lot shorter than it seems. So I guess I will say, before we have a couple minutes for questions, is that I think this analysis is very important when we talk about what needs to happen and how we need to move forward, because it shows us what we need is a political democracy that has systems that are accountable to everybody, but we also need a culture in which we can interact, where we understand that sometimes I'm gonna say things to you, and if you are a white woman and I'm a black man, there's gonna be a history of interaction that's gonna change how we hear that, right? And if you're a white man talking to a black woman, there's gonna be a history of interaction that changed that, which changed how our democracy has to work and function and the culture that underlies our democracy. And we also have to have economic democracy, where communities have control over their needs so folks can afford healthcare and folks can afford education. And we need a cultural democracy that understands how our stories of ourselves and the things that our cultures create empower us, how they teach us lessons of how to interact, but also how often they're commoditized and sold, and the benefits of the cultural production of different communities don't go back to those communities. So I guess should we take questions at the end after Omo, or we should take them now?
At the end.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much.
So, hello. If you at one point, any point cannot hear me, then you can just interrupt me and say, I can't hear you, or raise your hand, and I'll be like, what? And you'll be like, I can't hear you. So my name is Omolara Williams McAllister, and I actually think I know a fair number of you and have like met you in one-on-one engagements, but I'm going to introduce myself anyway. So you can call me O or Mo or Omo or Mola or Lara. Okay. I'm actually also just going to move my body because that might help. So people over there can still hear me. So you can call me O or Mo or Omo or Mola or Lara. You cannot call me Oma or Lara, so any of those other things will work. And then if you're not using my name, then you can call me she, as in I really like what she said, or I really hate what she said. You can refer to me as her, like I can't hear her, I wish she would talk more loudly. Or you can say hers, like I really don't agree with that viewpoint of hers. And I'm an artist and an educator, an organizer, I don't know, lots of other things. Here in DC, and I'm one of the co-instigators of Black Lives Matter. So I'm really excited, thank you, to be able to follow Aaron, because he got to do all the like heavy lifting intellectual stuff. And that means that I get to be like happy and singy. I'm gonna curate my own playlist to go with this here speech, whatever, talk, whatever we're calling it. And I'm gonna talk about relationships, which he mentioned and Kay mentioned. And it's gonna be a little explicit, so I'll give you that warning now. Explicit in the sense that there will be some, what my grandmother would call foul language, but very little of it, but it will exist. Just bear with me, or if it offends you, I will not be offended if you leave, so letting you know. So I'm gonna start with this like framework so that you can understand the rest of what I'm gonna say. And the framework is one that I actually use for evaluating people who are trying to date me. And this framework, you're gonna imagine in your mind a clock, and I'm gonna talk you through the clock. I call this framework the wheel of relationship. And the wheel of relationship. And so from like 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock on the clock, which I guess is over here for you all, 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, or maybe 12 to two, is the sugar honey iced tea, as in like the shit, people who are the shit. Those people are people who love you the way that you want to be loved and that you love yourself, who like honor the commitments that you make to each other. You have direct and open communication. You know, it's like sunshine and roses. And sometimes you disagree and you work out those disagreements in ways that are respectful to both of you and respect and appreciate both of your needs. So those people, sugar honey iced tea, it's like noon to 2 o'clock. And then from like 2 to 6 are people that you just don't remember. They're just like mediocrely good or mediocrely bad. So I had a friend, I was explaining the wheel of relationship to her, and she was like, yeah, there was this guy, I used to date him, and I really liked his dog. And the sad thing was that I remembered his dog's name, but I didn't remember his name. So whenever I saw him in the street, I'd be like, oh, hey, you know, and I'd greet the dog by name, and then I'd be like, how are you, person that I don't remember? So that's that range. That's like 2 o'clock to 6 o'clock. It's a lot of people, just like, we date a lot of people, and then it's like, oh yeah, that one person, I don't remember. And then from like 6 o'clock to maybe 8 o'clock are people who are a piece of shit. So they excel at being shitty. Those are the people who like make you all these promises and then they don't do the things they say they're gonna do. And maybe they're trying really hard, but they just don't do it. It's like, I can't remember the exact lyrics. I need to watch Lemonade more, but she has a song that's like, slow down, you don't love me like he loves me. It's like, you don't do it. Like, what is wrong with you? I don't get it, right? So those people are like hopelessly lost, and in many cases they're trying, they don't have ill will, but they still just aren't it. And they're spectacularly not it. So your friends will remember, they'll be like, remember that one guy who you used to let do whatever, and he would drive your car and then bring it back on empty and have crashed it and like whatever. Remember that guy? And you know his name because you're like, oh yeah, Tyrone. Oh my God, I hated that guy. So that's people who are a piece of shit. And then from like 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock are the worst kind of people in the wheel. The worst kind of people. These are people who colloquially refer to, in my family, and I know in other black communities, as ain't shit. As in, you ain't shit. Now, ain't shit people, ain't shit, as in you ain't shit, as in A-I-N apostrophe T, shit. And these people are people who appear to be the shit, but are actually a piece of shit. So when they're with you, they do all of the things that they say they're going to do, that they're supposed to do, and then when they're not with you, they are not with you. They are with whoever they are with, doing whatever they want to do, however they want to do it, and they're lying with you when they're with you because they're telling you that they're not doing those things, or they're just not telling you, which is, you know, omission. And so I say all of that to say that I've been in a relationship as an organizer, Black Lives Matter organizer, with the Unitarian Universalist Church. And so that's both the church with a big C, as in like the superstructure church, the regional group of churches, and church with a little C, as in like individual churches and groups of people have invited me to various things. So permit me a brief history of our relationship. So it began, and you all might not know this song, but I'm going to sing it anyway because I curated it in my playlist for this talk. So there's this song by this man, like, Music Soulchild, and I think our relationship started like this. So it's like, I ain't trying to pressure you, just can't stop thinking about you. I ain't even really trying to be your boyfriend. I just want to know your name, maybe sometime. We could hook up, hang out, just chill, right? So you all came in and you were like, I'm not trying to pressure you. I just, you know, keep thinking about you. I want to be friends. Like, let's hang out. Let's chill. So you'd invite me to like intimate spaces, to have like one-on-one conversations. You would like show up to my stuff and be supportive and be like, hey, this is my name. This is great. You know, like, I'm you. And everybody's like, I'm you. And I was like, that's cool. And then we got to the point where you all started like introducing me to your friends and family, and like taking me out in public. You were like, hey, do you want to come to this thing? Like, my kids are there. Oh, by the way, this is my partner. Like, come meet my other friends. You know, we're going out in public places. Come speak here. I'll introduce you. It's going to be great. And so I was like, that's really cool too. Awesome. Like, now we're public. We're publicly in some type of relationship. That's wonderful. And we've been doing that for a little while. Like, this is maybe the third or fourth time that many, perhaps most of you, have heard me speak in some sort of space, I think. And then there are others that this may be the first time. And so we're getting to that place, another song, where you gotta love it or leave it alone. You gotta love it or leave it alone. So the expectations are shifting, right? Like, you all so far have been the sugar honey ice. And you've done that as you use with the big C and the little C by like making sure that you follow the lead of black organizers and black organizations in your Black Lives Matter work. You've been compensating us for our labor. So there's no exploitative labor politics. You're not like, hey, I want you to come do all this work. Oops, we don't got no money. You have been communicating appropriately. So you send somebody who you know that I enjoy talking with or that I have good communication with, that's the person that talks to me. It's only that one person. It's not like five people, you know, and that person, if I say I want to talk to you anymore, they don't talk to me anymore. They respect my boundaries, so that's really nice. They respect that I'm human, so sometimes, you know, like human stuff happens and they're like, oh, how can we support you? As opposed to like, that's crappy. We're never going to work with you ever, ever again. And, you know, even though I'm not always there when you call, you accept that I'm always on time, which also might be a reference that doesn't make sense. So now we've gotten to that place where, like, I know your families, and I know your partners, and we've been out in public, and so the question is, are you trying to shit or get off the pot with your commitment to Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter movement, right? So we're gonna have this talk now. Like, you're all seated, hopefully comfortably. And I'm coming to you to say that what you've done has been fabulous. It's been lovely. It's exactly what you would expect people to do. And now that we are friends, as my mom would say, when it's like ambiguous and you keep bringing somebody around, it's like, oh yeah, that's her little friend. Like, we don't know if that's like her boo or her partner, whoever, but that's like her little friend that she brings around. Now that we are friends, I would like to be more than friends. And what that means is that we have a new level of expectation for you as a little C church and as a big C church. And that means that you are no longer, you're striving to no longer be in this category where you're on the precipice. Either you keep doing what you're doing, and then you'll come in this category, or you'll, you know, evolve and you'll move to a new category. That category on the wheel of relationship, right? We're like looking at staying in the shit category where you are, as opposed to like fading into mediocrity or becoming, you know, a piece of shit. Or we really, really, really don't want to become, what is it?
Shit.
We're not trying to become a shit. We don't want to do that. That's not good. And so I couldn't find a song in my vocabulary of songs to like describe the people that I don't want you to be. And so I wrote a little song, a little chorus, a little tiny chorus about those people. And there's a lot of them around. I'm going to talk a little bit about them, not by name, because that's rude, or maybe by name, because that's loving accountability. But the people that I'm talking about, they are neoliberalists. Self-proclaimed, can call five black organizers by number and by name, comes to all of my shit and even throws their own, but when it really comes down to it, they ain't trying to do the white work, they ain't trying to do the white work, they ain't trying to do the white work. Faux allies. So what are they called?
Faux allies.
And what are they? Can do you remember the rest of it?
They're
neoliberalists. Self-proclaimed. That part is really important. Self-proclaimed. Can call five black organizers by phone number and by name. They show up to all of my shit. They even throw their own, like this right here. But when it really comes down to it, they ain't trying to do the white work. They ain't trying to do the white work. They ain't trying to do the white work. Faux allies. Did we catch more of it that time? Who are they? What can we describe the, can I get, so we got the faux allies. They're not trying to do the white work. Other qualities of them, y'all remember any of it? They're self-proclaimed, that's important. They know the numbers of five black organizers and their names. They come to all the stuff. They throw their own. Right? But when it really comes down to it, they're not trying to do the white work. Now, I want to acknowledge that, like, maybe half, maybe a quarter, three, a third of y'all are not white people. Right? You is not all white folks. But it's a lot of white folks. Right? And it's a lot of white institutional power and privilege. And it's a lot of white resources. Right? Which Aaron was talking about a little bit. Which is why I'm referring to it as the white work. But let me be explicit that part of the white work includes taking care of the black folk who are within your institution, which means investing in healing work for those black people and not putting the burden of fixing your white people shit that you created yourselves on those very same black people. Especially if they don't want to do it. Now if they say like, I will do it, you know, handle your shit, then that's fine, and you should support them appropriately. But if they're like, nah, I'm not really trying to mess with you, like, I'm over here just trying to live, then you should be like, how can I support you? And whatever they say, that's how you can support them, whatever it is. Might not be what you want to hear. You might want to, like, throw money at them. And they might not want money. They might want massages. They might want you to get their groceries. They might want you to watch their children. You know, whatever people need is what they need. And so what it looks like now to not be ain't shit and to be the shit in relationship with Black Lives Matter DC, I will speak for us, but I will also say that we come with friends in the Black organizing community. And lately, we have had a spate of accountability holding, loving accountability holding. Some of that has been with organizations that you may recognize, like Jews United for Justice, self-proclaimed, but when it really comes down to it, they ain't trying to do the white work. But they got the Black Lives Matter signs in the yards. And you know what? They can call five Black organizers by number and by name. And they come to all of my shit, regularly throw their own. Not it, y'all. It's just not it. So for them, they're like, and we're having a conversation right now with them about loving accountability and not being ain't shit, right? We don't want to even get to that conversation. So what we want to do is you want to invest institutional resources, big C, churches, little C, like individual churches, in having trainings for your folks so they can get their education level up and so they actually know what it looks like to do this work. So we hear a lot about the theory. Aaron gave you a lot of history and theory. But when it really comes down to it, like, what do you do when you see an instance of oppression or injustice? How do you deal with that? People don't know because they've never been taught. And people don't know because they've explicitly been taught to not say anything, to function in a culture of silence. And so the way that you are then able to learn to address that is by investing in training to be able to figure out how to do it. So the first thing is investing in training. Training looks different. So just a brief thing on fairness versus justice. Like, training looks different if you are being directly impacted by a system of oppression than if you are someone who is being privileged by it. So for Black folks and folks who are impacted by intersectional oppression, so it's not just Black folks, but other people who are impacted by intersectional oppression in your organization, that looks like first healing, because you can't do that work if you're just trying to keep your head above the water. Right, so healing in a separate space where the people who are doing the oppressing are not present, where folks can work out their stuff with each other, work out their stuff with themselves, work out their stuff with their God, if that's the thing that they need to do. And then separately, on the other side, you got the people who are doing a lot of the oppressing, who are learning how to unlearn those oppressive tendencies, how to make an apology if they do something, how to then be able to learn to accept loving accountability. So if you don't have the wherewithal to accept an apology, I will be over there teaching the Black people how to hold you accountable. And so when they say, you need to be able to say, I'm gonna sit with it in silence. I'm gonna formulate my apology that I learned how to make, and then I'm gonna walk away, and I'm gonna do the white work with my white people, right? And I'm gonna continue to invest in resources, and I'm not gonna say, damn, that Omalar really doesn't like me, or like, she's a really angry Black woman, or why does that person never answer my phone calls? Maybe you'll say like, what the fuck am I doing to make it so hard for that person to be in the same space as me, right? So trainings are geared towards teaching you those actual tools as opposed to having these conversations that we're having that are like theoretical. The second one is fundraising. So it takes money to do this kind of work. And because of one of the pillars of white supremacy that Aaron mentioned, economic disenfranchisement, it can be really difficult to get a hold of money, not only when you are Black and facing regular racism, but also when you are Black and radical and people are coming for you because you are giving breakfast to little Black children. Do y'all know what I'm talking about?
The Black Panthers.
Right. We're like, damn, y'all are feeding Black children. Those people are gonna be on your side. We don't want you to get them to do anything else, right? And so we are out here healing Black people. We're doing emotional emancipation. We are saying white supremacy in our workplaces and wherever we go. We are talking about anti-Black racism. We are holding people accountable. People that we're holding accountable are institutions that are like, but we just raised money for you. Like, doesn't that mean that we get away from accountability? No, right? And so then those institutions are like, y'all shouldn't give them money. You shouldn't have them do that work. So it looks like fundraising, investing in making sure that we're able to continue doing this work on the scale that we are interested in doing it. And the third one, this one might be hard to hear, is institutional restructure. So I appreciate that y'all like have us here. Like I said, you introduced me to your family and your friends and your children, right? That's nice. Like, you have me come and visit. That's cute. Not really, haven't really done any training, so like we're moving into that space. And even if you do the trainings, and when you do the trainings, you will start to be forced to restructure as an institution if the people are actually taking in the things that they're trained. But then you have to start looking at the places, where do we as the UU church, and now I'm gonna say like all caps, so that's looking across the entire, like, I don't know if you all have conventions, in the UCC we have, yeah. Looking across the entire convention, but then also big C, and I'm talking about the regional when I use big C, and like little C individual churches, what are the ways that we have practices, that we have policies, that we have cultures, that we just have ways of being that we haven't thought about that are racist, that are built into how we do stuff? What are those ways? And how can we transform them so that they are not that way? And how can we do the transforming without placing the entire burden of transformation on the backs of the people who have been bearing the weight of our systemic injustice this entire time? Big questions, but they all have answers, right? And part of the thing, part of the way to answer them is to bring in people who have thought about how you answer these, who have worked with other organizations to do it, rather than doing a thing that organizations like to do, which is like convene a committee, and they'll have a committee of people from their organization, and the people from that organization will not have done any training in racial equity or racial justice, and so they will sit around and they will be like, we should fix this, how do we do it? We don't know, but we really want to fix this, and they will do that infinitely, just like around and around and around, and it will never occur to them, maybe we should ask somebody who knows. So just start there, just ask somebody who knows, bring them in to do those trainings, to do those analysis, to help you work through these things, to help you be the shit instead of
ain't shit.
So that's what I have to say. Thank you all for dealing with my foul language. And I guess we'll do...
Just think you ain't
foul. That's what my grandma says. She's like, foul. She says foul in this really foul way, too. Like, you feel how foul it is. She says foul, you're like, okay, I won't do it anymore. Are we doing questions now, Kay? Okay.
Lovelessness.
Lovelessness.
Yeah.
And in a way, that is more sophisticated and less irritating than the term hatred, and maybe therefore more useful as a way of thinking mindfully about what these silos are about. So would you say a little bit more about lovelessness and its antithesis?
Yeah, I think oftentimes we focus on the hatred, one, because we have a really narrow understanding of what hatred looks like, and it's always this overt bigotry. So like Donald Trump banning all Muslims is hatred. And then like Bernie Sanders not really talking about black people
It's just like, you know, he's all right. Like, he doesn't hate us. Even if his policies don't help us, even if his policies end up in a genocide of black people in poor communities, it's cool because he doesn't hate us. But the real problem is that people don't love us. What we're asking you to do is love us, and that's an active thing. Love is not a passive thing. You don't passively love people. When you love somebody, it compels you to do what's best for them. It compels you to not only transform yourself to be somebody who is worthy of them loving you, but when you love somebody, you also transform the context in which your relationship exists. When you love somebody, you have to be like, what are these things that are stopping this person, or as Omar often says, my beloved, from being with me now? What are the structures and the systems that stop us from being together? And that's the distinction, right? I think that love forces us to act, and when we focus too much on hatred, one, we focus too much on what we don't want and not on what we're trying to build. But we also, you cannot hate somebody but allow hatred to exist around you. But I've never seen somebody love somebody and allow the hatred of the person they love to exist around them.
And further, I think, so one of the things that we tend to do is shift language into the ways that we want to perceive the world. So you said this in one, because you were like, lovelessness focuses on the lack of love. So it's really important to be oriented towards your goal, towards where you want to get. And so hatred is a mere statement of where we are, but it doesn't actually point to what we're trying to get to, or what is lacking, or what the solution is. So having like solution-oriented language, or language that even in describing what it is that it shouldn't be, that says this is what we're trying to get to, is really important. So when you say lovelessness, then you've already grounded yourself in a conversation about love, and you already know what the solution is, right? It's like having love present. It's one of the reasons that people often talk about anti-oppression work, and I talk about work to celebrate and affirm people's humanity, because I'm interested in moving towards celebrating and affirming people's humanity rather than in moving to a place of anti-oppression. What is anti-oppression? I don't know, but I know what it looks like to celebrate and affirm people's humanity.
Go here and then here. Yeah, do y'all remember when the Bundy took over the federal land in Oregon? I was really taken aback by the left's response to that.
That's such a diplomatic term and not actually how you felt.
Well, everybody, it was just like all of this classism, like look at what they named themselves. Right. They took over this federal land. And I was like, that sounds dope. Before I heard about their politics, I was like, they took over federal land. And I'm from Colorado, I'm from rural Colorado. And so I understand what the federal government does to local farmers. And there is this moment where we could have gone in and be like, yeah, you guys are right. The federal government is screwing you over. They're making you pay them for this land that they gave you 100 years ago. And the only reason they're doing that is because there's no way to make money. And there was this point where everybody was like, but it wasn't originally their land. They took it from First Nation peoples and they're just racist. And I wanted to be like, there was this beautiful moment that happened where the community was like, we're not racist, and told the Bundy folks to leave. And I feel like because folks just want to blame low-income and class-oppressed white people for their racism, there wasn't anybody who wanted to go in to those people who pushed them out because they like they don't want to be racist and be like, let's bring in the First Nation people who actually have a right to this land, and let's come up with a real agenda to address all of our issues because they're so interconnected. And I think that we have this problem where we do two things, right? We focus on class to the exclusion of race,
which means that like there's the socialist and the Bernie Bros and all of these folks who are like, yeah, but the real problem with racism is class. And so if we fix that, we'll be good. And then you have folks who are like, no, we've tried that. Every time you say you're just gonna do class, black people get screwed over. And the thing that I want to communicate most about black liberation is that I actually view it as this is the central thing. Blackness has been crafted at the bottom of every hierarchy. Black women are at the bottom of the gender hierarchy. Black and Afro-Latinos are the bottom of even that racial hierarchy. We often forget that a pluralistic number of Muslims in America are actually black, right? And so when you take away the restrictions on the identity of blackness, you actually take away all of these other boxes that we put people in, right? So you have to situate black liberation amongst this larger struggle for collective liberation, which says there actually aren't good and bad people. There are class interests and all of these different systems that enforce class interests on our bodies and enforce a system of lovelessness to separate us and make it difficult to dismantle that. We reached out to the Surge National to talk about having that framing, and there are folks in the BLM network who are talking about organizing it with like the Rural Organizing Project and Southerners on New Ground who do that sort of low, like working class across race work.
One of the things I thought was interesting in this guy, this Blendy movement, how many of you have heard of a movement in Philadelphia called MOVE, M-O-V?
Yeah.
You're dating yourself, so see?
What? I'm not dating myself.
You've heard of it?
Yeah. Okay. BLM is well aware of MOVE.
But you were probably a little girl when they were active.
No. So it's not about being a little girl or even being alive. It's about doing your research and understanding.
Okay, well, yes. A lot of people, this is. There was a movement in Philadelphia back in the 1970s called MOVE, M-O-V-E. This is a group of African American. They lived in a communal society. They had all kinds of, I would say, kind of bizarre philosophies. You know, they didn't like to take baths. They didn't like to do a lot of things. I think they had plural marriage, structure. But they had guns. You know, they made no bones about the fact that they were brandishing guns. The reaction of the Philadelphia Police Department was to try to forcibly disarm them in the process in which, I don't know how many people were actually killed, but they incinerated an entire city block. And all of the initial violence was committed by the Philadelphia Police Department. The people did react in self-defense. But then you have these folks out here with the cowboy hats and their rifles and their anti-Obama racist, you know, slogans, you know, and they just basically sat there and hoped that they would go away and waited for them to, you know. So, I mean, the reaction against these armed black folks in Philadelphia was so different, so totally different from what it was these cowboys out in the West. There's a huge contrast between the two.
It's true, and sometimes black folks don't even provoke that sort of violence. So like there's Oklahoma City, which is like a thriving black economy, black society that was working with itself, and that whole city was actually bombed and destroyed.
Yeah, that was Tulsa. That was in Tulsa.
Tulsa, sorry. So like, it doesn't even require that, but the thing that I wanted to add to this particular thing is partially going back to the thing that I was saying, which is what the white work is, the institutional work of making sure that people have access to be able to do healing and to be properly supported, to be able to participate how they choose to participate in this kind of work. And the reason why that is important is because I'm gonna go back to one thing Aaron said. So Aaron talked about the creation of white supremacy and the context in which it was created. And part of that context was specifically to align poor white folks who were then poor Irish folks who were working as indentured laborers against the people who came in from the continent. And so embedded in the construct of white supremacy is this idea that shit, if the poor people all come for us together, we are fucked. And so the system is built to explicitly keep us away from each other, and part of the way that it does that is trauma. And so people have trauma that makes it impossible for some black people to stand here and talk to a group like this,
or to be interested in working with any white people or any non-black people, or any people who aren't already in a place where they can respect their humanity, respect and even actively protect it from other people who are, might come against it. So it's important to remember that when you talk about like, oh, we need to make sure that people can work with these people or work together or frame these things in important ways. The question you ask is, how are we supporting people so that they can show up for themselves and so that they can show up for the movement? And we haven't done that work.
During the 1960s, there were sort of one way to categorize a lot of the active black organizations was a category which some people might, you know, take issue with, what's called cultural nationalists and revolutionary nationalists. Okay. Now, the cultural nationalists, the Black Panthers referred to as pork chop nationalists. The cultural nationalists were folks who said, we just got to get our share of American pie. We need black banks, and we need black churches, and we need to, you know, have black capitalism. We need to have parallel institutions of our community. Those are the cultural nationalists. And we're going to do this on the basis of Afrocentric culture. And forget all these white folks, forget all these Mexicans, and forget all these other folks. We're going to get our own little piece of the American pie. Then there were the revolutionary nationalists, the most well-known group of whom were the Black Panther Party. But there was another group in Detroit called DRUM, Dodge Revolutionary Action Movement. And those folks were informed more by a class perspective and also more by a global perspective. There's a book that you all should take a look at if you haven't. It's called The Glass House Tapes by Lewis Tackwood. And Lewis Tackwood was a double agent who was a police informer who was working for the Los Angeles Police Department. And he was also at the same time working for a cultural nationalist group in Los Angeles called US, United Slaves. And part of his job was to incite conflict between the Black Panther Party and the US groups. And this resulted in actually a shootout that took place on the campus at UCLA. In which two young Black Panthers were gunned down by members of US. But all over Los Angeles and in various parts of the country, there was this conflict going on between these militant black organizations. And there was a connection. There was a program called COINTELPRO during the 1960s, counterintelligence program that was initiated by the FBI in league with secret organizations and local police departments. And part of what they did was to promote black nationalism, promote cultural nationalism, and to set groups against each other.
You had two other questions, right? And I also thought
say what she said.
All right, thanks.
And in talking to them, we talked about Black Lives Matter, that was the conversation. The upside is on June 25th, Habitat for Humanity and the Queen Mall are going to have a rally in support of Black Lives Matter. I don't know that it's going to raise any money for it, but it will appease me. The person who's going to be responsible for the Habitat is a guy named Reverend Todd Gray, and he's getting about Black Lives Matter. You were saying in your talk that there are different ways to support you and that some ways are less usable than others. I was wondering, would you consider this to be a positive way to support Black Lives Matter?
So I'm going to restate the question, which has some context around it. So the question, the end question was, would I consider the scenario that was presented, which I'll tell you, to be something that goes in my like relationship, my clock of something that is actually useful and supportive or not? And so the scenario is that, what is your name?
It's Janet.
Is that Janet works with Habitat for Humanity. Habitat for Humanity is partnering with another organization.
Actually, I'm a member of Paint Branch. I've been trying to partner with Habitat so that we could get.
Paint Branch and Habitat are partnering together. And on the 25th of June, they are doing a rally for Black Lives Matter. Unsure of whether it's raising money or not, there's a Reverend Todd Gray who is leading the efforts and who's bringing in political people and people to talk and things like that. The question is, where does this fall? How would I consider this in terms of its relationship to the work that Black Lives Matter, DMV, is doing? So So the first thing that I would say is I have not heard of this, and that's really interesting that they are planning a Black Lives Matter thing. Maybe they're working with another group of Black organizers that we don't know, but we just had Black organizer dinner on Thursday, and we talk pretty frequently, and nobody has mentioned it. So my first question would be, are they actually working with people who do Black Lives Matter organizing work? And if they are, and they already have a date, and it's already public, and they already have people who are leading it, then at what point do you invite people who have been doing this work in the area into that conversation? The correct answer to that would be at the very front, because the question would be, how can we support the work that you're doing, rather than we want to throw a rally, will you come speak at our rally that we want to throw? And so I haven't heard about this. I don't know what it is. I'm sure that like they're excited to talk about supporting Black Lives Matter. It sounds like to me, from the way that it is constructed, that it is most likely just an opportunity for them to give lip service to the movement, and that's not helpful. Maybe they're thinking that it'll like raise awareness or publicity. My question would be, raise awareness of what, publicity for whom? And so I mean, what is your?
Yeah, I agree. One thing I would say is kind of to the move point. One thing I'm really interested in is Black spaces east of the river. And we're trying to fundraise for a space for Black folks. And one of the things we recognize is that like there has to be this connection to parts of society that the police aren't just gonna bomb. And so like what would be more useful is for like Habitat and places that build up buildings to get us, to help us get a building and then fix it up and have it be a community center, right? That's actually supporting us with the skills and the resources that you already have, and it's already part of your mission.
And we've actually built a fair amount of infrastructure. So one of the things that's unique about the DC chapter of Black Lives Matter is that we, over the last year and a half that we've existed, have built incredible infrastructure for ourselves. One of the parts of that is a spokes council. So at the spokes council, people who are interested in supporting Black liberation can come and say, we're interested in supporting Black liberation. And in that space, we say, these are all the things that we need and that we want and that we're trying to do. What can you add, what do you have that you can add to this? And we can have conversations that's like, oh, well, I have access to this, and I have access to that, and I have access to that, and you can use these things. And then we'll say, okay, well, how do we get them? What do we, you know, and plan forward from there. So there actually are multiple spaces that exist to be able to engage us for folks who want to support us. And they're really easy to find. Like, they're real Googleable. Like, I'm pretty sure that you can find my address, my phone number, and all of my email addresses.
Because people do. People I don't want to do, so I know people who want to can.
Yeah.
Right.
You were saying I
have this hand that was up quite some time before yours, so I want to respect the staff. So I'll go here and then come to you.
Thank you. And I want to thank each of you because you each of you have presented a different perspective that has fed my heart and my head and my soul, and I really love that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Loving accountability, is there a question in your statement?
There is, so I need to know more about, I need to find out more about that.
About how to get trainings into your church?
Not training, it's not just training, it's ongoing.
Right, about how to get, so when I say training, I don't actually mean like a workshop, I mean, having an actual commitment to, like, we're going to sit down, we're going to make a plan for the next 3 years.
Yes.
About how we're going to have trainings across our churches to be able to support this ongoing work.
To support me in my ongoing recovery.
Right. And so we've given you I've said, like, these are the things you need to do if you want to not be ain't shit, right? And so now, actually, it's up to you all, because you are the people who are within the organization. You are the UU folks. And so if you go back and you're like, you know what, it's okay if I'm on Black Lives Matter shit list. That's fine, right? Then that's the decision that you make, and you get loving accountability in return. But if you decide, like, you know what, actually, we're committed to this work, we're in it, we want to do it, then now you have to push your institution
right.
from the inside
right.
to do that work. And so that's not a question for me. That is a demand that you then pose.
One of the things that came out in our discussion in the caucus this morning, and several of us shared this, was that in our congregations there seems to be an inertia, you know, a lack of real initiative to get behind our racial justice task force and our racial justice groups. I mean, I was working with UULM in terms of police accountability. It was a struggle to mobilize people. It was a real struggle. So I'm going to ask all of you here who live in this area, you're going to be hearing from us in the fall, because this issue of police accountability is ongoing. Like Karen said, we achieved a few minor victories. But we're going to ask you to put your money where your mouth is and get behind us, come to Annapolis, contact your legislators, because that's a key part of Black Lives Matter.
And
one second piece is listening to all of you. And the question that I've been sitting with for a while now is that we need to redo our social contract in this country. And I'm questioning whether it's enough to is dismantling.
The only problem I have with Bernie is that his revolution doesn't go far enough. You know, he's the only. You know, he's
one
of
the.
He's not a
revolutionary.
He's the only major national figure I've ever heard even use that word,
yes.
Let alone in terms of what he's really prepared to do.
I mean, Reagan did say revolution.
I want to raise two things. The first thing that I want to raise is that, out of respect for my own body, which is now telling me that I need food, I'm going to go and procure some food for myself. The second thing is that it sounds like you need a space to be able to do white work. So the questions that you are asking now of us as Black organizers are partially part of conversations that y'all need to have internally. So part of what I've been hearing you say, and the way that you're contextualizing it and you're asking questions, like, these are healthy, these are good. I'm working on a different scale with people in terms of organizational transformation. And so I can engage in those kinds of conversations. I'm not prepared to today, and the appropriate spaces for them are ongoing trainings where you're working through those conversations.
If I could offer that maybe one opportunity for having those discussions is at GA this year for those who are going, because I think there is a track. What's the name?
It's the Black Lives Matter track.
The Black Lives of UU track.
Right.
Black Lives of UU track.
Yeah,
some
right.
of that track will be involve caucusing.
So I do know that Erica, too, Erica Totten, who's our resident healer, will be doing a healing track that is for Blackness only.
At the GA?
One thing I will say is, if you look at the Well Examined Life, which is my blog, you can see the case for interpersonal reparations, which talks a lot about individual things folks can do in setting that up. I also run a consultancy group, Emergence Transformation and Consulting, which does this work. And so if folks are interested, you can always pay me and my friends to come into your organization and do it. The last thing I will say is, I think Grace Lee Boggs has a really good distinction between rebellion and revolution, which is, a rebellion is when you go and you tell people, you need to hear our claims and you need to fix it and you need to actually address us and enfranchise us. And a revolution is when you come in and say, we're taking power, and we're taking power over our own self-determination. And so I think, you know, Bernie Sanders is a political rebellion within the system, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But to be fair, that's what Reagan did. And Reagan, I think, completely revolutionized whole aspects of our society and our social construct. So, you know, take that for what it's worth.
And finally, oh, Michelle, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna, yeah. I know she had the next question.
Yes, I wanted to
a little louder, please.
Yeah, so one of our many projects is looking for a space to have as a community space and a community control the movement for Black Lives, where we could have folks who are living and doing organizing, where we could distribute survival programs and food and timeshares, and just have a culture of resistance, kind of modeling after Maroon societies in the Caribbean. And as folks are probably really aware, space is really expensive in DC, and so we're looking for folks who have connections to folks who actually own land, folks who have connections to a lot of money, folks who have connections to folks who know how to fix up decrepit buildings to come together and help us get that space, but also do the ongoing work of protecting that space, protecting it politically and protecting it physically by, you know, being publicly in support of it, so the police can't just drop an incendiary bomb on our community.
I hear a lot of discussion about, you know, what can white people do, and I can't answer that. I have no answer for that. What I can tell you is what all of us as global citizens can do, because this Black Lives Matter movement is part of a whole that is much, much greater, because it goes around the world. And it extends in the back streets of Fallujah, it extends in the side streets of Bedford-Stuyvesant, it's in South Los Angeles, it's in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro. What we need is what King talked about, it's a revolutionary, global revolution of values in the spirit. We don't have to pick up the gun. People are gonna pick up the guns against us, and so we've got to be not afraid of that. We've got to be able to withstand that. But we've got to change the fundamental structure of modern global civilization. That's what it's about.
So I'm mindful of what Omalara said, which is that she recognized her body needs to eat, and our intention was to be breaking to break bread and have food together. And so I'd like to, unless either of you object, I'd like us to have a time for lunch. And I hope that people already heard Omalara and Aaron specifically share ways that people who are involved in wanting to be in that sweet shit category and showing up and doing more work and being in relationship, like some of the ways to do that beyond asking a question right now. Because I think relationship is going to involve a lot more. And I want to apologize because I know that some of us were not able to hear all of what was being said. That is on me, it's a question of the space. The space was not honoring the panelists and making it possible for all of us to hear them as well as they deserve to be heard. That is on me, and Barbara has recorded a lot of it, and I tried to take notes. So if you didn't hear, there were ways that were shared for you to continue learning and staying in touch with Omalara and with Aaron and with Alonzo. And if you didn't hear what those were, if you talk with me or email me, I can do my very best to help you with some of those key phrases that you can Google and other ways that you can do that. And hopefully we'll have the recording available at some point, possibly parts of it, it may not be in its entirety, so that you can watch it and be able to hear words that you may have missed because the acoustics and the mics were not here and our panelists deserved them. So that was the problem that existed on that level. So
invite everyone to lunch. There are box lunches